Hey, today's episode is brought to you by Sunset Lake CBD. We've talked about Sunset Lake CBD quite a bit around here. We are all big fans of their various products. You'll recall they are a farm located outside of Burlington, Vermont. They used to exclusively be a dairy farm for Ben and Jerry's ice cream. They decided to diversify. They work with the University of Vermont, which is apparently one of the foremost, academic researchers about CBD growing. Their hemp is 100% pesticide free. They only use organic fertilizers. You can look at their the third party analysis of what they sell on their website. They have great business practices, $15 a minimum wage, and employees own a majority of the company. But best of all, their products are awesome. As far as I know, we were all CBD skeptics around here. I am now a regular user of various tinctures that they have. They get the 750 mil. They got the 1500. Now they got a 3000 milliliter. You can't find that. I've never found that before. Helps me go to sleep in situations where I don't want to get angry at my children because they drive me crazy. Sometimes they'll take a little bit. They have gummy bears if you want that are CBD gummy bears. They have this amazing topical salve that has beeswax in it and arnica and 500 meg of CBD, and I use it on my eczema. And that some people have not had the same success on their eczema, but everybody who has used it has told me that it's great for like their arthritis or they had problems with their back. There's also a great farmer's roast CBD coffee. That's my weekend brew. Take the edge off a little bit, but still get my caffeine fix. And their smokables are awesome. I'm actually starting to get into, I'm going to be careful because I don't want to ever fall back into like the cigarette thing. But they're, I tried the pre-rolls and it's a nice like, it's a body buzz, I guess. Not so much the, none of the sort of the psychedelic quality of it. And Matt, you're a huge fan, right?
I'm a big fan of the smalls too, but that's good that, because I feel like a pre-rolled CBD joint is much better for you than a cigarette. So maybe that's.
Oh, definitely. Well, I don't smoke cigarettes anymore. I just don't like, I don't want to get back into that, that mindset, if you will. But it's nice. I just take a couple of drags of it and it's a great way to relax your body. And the best is, they're fans of the show and they're giving us 20% off for anybody who uses the coupon code left is best. One word, left is best. 20% off at sunsetlakecbd.com. Sunsetlakecbd.com. Start the show. It is Tuesday, September 15th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Baffler co-founder, author of What's the Matter with Kansas, Thomas Frank on his latest, The People Know, N-O, A Brief History of Populism. Meanwhile, Wisconsin State Supreme Court says ballots can be counted, can be mailed, now. In Pennsylvania, ballots are on hold, tied up in court. Meanwhile, scientists fear that two of the most important Arctic glaciers in the world are tearing loose. Going to raise sea levels dramatically. Different federal courts, a federal court rules that Chad Wolf is illegally serving as DHS head and blocks temporarily some of his asylum restrictions. Meanwhile, a different federal court says that Trump can throw thousands of refugees who have been here for decades out of the country, tearing them apart from about 250,000 U.S. citizens, family members. Whistleblower tells of COVID run rampant at for-profit immigration detention centers, private prisons, basically. And there are hints of mass hysterectomies. From the administration to the right-wing fever swamps, calls for and about armed revolt. We are 7 weeks out from the election. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining us. Sorry we're having a little bit of technical difficulties with the audio mix up front. We are working right now, and by we, of course, I mean Kyle, are working on a wholly new system, one which Kyle owes it to the world to release to the broader public, I think. But Kyle is working on something that is going to upgrade the quality of our audio, upgrade the quality of our video, upgrade just all sorts of upgrades. So we are very much anticipating that. It's exciting. We're trucking along here on the program, trying to get it all done. Still in many ways catching our breath from both the idea of moving all remote and frankly, from Michael's loss. And so we appreciate when you bear with us when we have technical issues and when we, this week in particular, Brendan is out. And so it's, we're a little bit under the gun, but we will endeavor to persevere. We have 7 weeks until the election. Obviously, we have a lot of election news. There's a lot of anxiety going around. There's a lot of insanity on the right. All this and more, we will be here every day until the election, except for, of course, on weekends. We still haven't figured out what we're going to do for the election. Originally, we were going to, it's the 10-year anniversary of this program. We were going to do an all-day thing. Maybe I'll talk about this tomorrow because we've got a news day tomorrow. Just a reminder, you can support this program by becoming a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, we cut out all the commercials, incidentally. Getting a decent amount of ads these days. Towards the end of the year, of Q4, an election year. And with, more online stuff. So that's a little bit helpful. Meanwhile, the latest and maybe the last audio drop from from Bob Woodward's monetization tour. Here is the last conversation that he had with Donald Trump. This was in April. Now, can you just imagine that, okay, he's wrapped everything up. Even if in April he had let the public know about the conversations he had had in February, that would have made a difference. If it makes a difference today, it would have made a difference in terms of thousands of lives before. Nevertheless, here is the conversation, the last conversation Bob Woodward had with Donald Trump, talking about COVID.
This thing is a killer if it gets you. If you're the wrong person, you don't have a chance.
Yes, yes, exactly. This is a scourge, and
it is the plague. And Bob, it's so easily transmissible, you wouldn't even believe it.
I know.
You can be in the room. I was in the White House a couple of days ago, a meeting of 10 people in the Oval Office, and a guy sneezed innocently, not a horrible, just a sneeze. The entire room bailed out, okay, including me, by the way.
There you go. That's an April 13th. He's bailing out of a meeting because somebody sneezed innocently. Let's look at what he was saying at that time. This is his Twitter. Here it is. On April 17th, right? On April 13th, he's saying this thing is a plague. You'll bail out. This thing will kill you. If you're the wrong person, you don't have a chance. I bailed out when someone sneezed. 4 days later, here he is saying, liberate Virginia and save your Second Amendment. It's under siege. Liberate Michigan. Liberate Minnesota. In other words, stop stop actually being suppressed by this fake coronavirus hoax. This is the message he's putting out there 4 days after he said this. And now, remember, if he had said what he said in February 7th, and then on April 13th, he had said, you know, instead of saying it April 13th, he had said it on February 8th, you would see a consistency on his attitude towards this whole thing. And then just compare all his comments from February 7th to April 17th. Then he wasn't, you know, he's an idiot, but he's not an idiot about this. He knows. He's just like the rest of the, you know, the lives that we would spare. They're not my life. I think that's pretty poignant. From February 7th to April 13th, that guy's perspective on this didn't seem to change an iota privately. And it didn't seem to change an iota publicly either, frankly.
Psycho, you're talking about fleeing the room, and this is the attitude you've had publicly towards the coronavirus?
For through February, through March, into April. For 2.5 months, when literally tens of thousands of people have died. That's pretty stunning. I imagine that will in some way impact him going forward. All right, we got a couple ads before we get to Thomas Frank. I'm very excited to see him. As you know, folks, I am a little sartorially challenged. It's hard to buy clothes online in particular because you don't know if your size is what you want. Well, for me, one of my solutions has been Stitch Fix. It's a personal styling company that makes getting the clothes you love effortless. It's a completely different way to shop. It's about you every time. To get started, this is what you do. You go to stitchfix.com/majority. You set up your profile. They ask you, like, what kind of clothes you like. And, you know, dumpy is not a choice. So I had to actually get more specific with my clothing choices. But they ask you what brands you wear, what colors you like, what styles. And then you pay a $20 styling fee for each fix, and that's credited towards anything that you keep. You can schedule at any time. There's no subscription required. And what they do is they send you a bunch of clothes based upon your selections. Shipping, returns, exchanges, super easy, super free. They do the hard work for you. For me, I've gotten two articles of clothing that have become sort of, I don't know, staples of mine, I would say. One is the Chukka boots. I don't think they're called Chukka. They're Chukka or Chukka, whatever. Brendan knows what they are, how they're pronounced. But they're basically like desert boots. But I wear these. These are my sort of like when I want to go out and, you know, pretend like I'm an adult. I wear these boot shoes, and they're great. And then I have that other, the Flag and Anthem. It's literally like a jean pants. But it's a little bit more, a little classier than jeans, but they fit in the same way. And they fit. You can check it out. You can get started today at stitchfix.com/majority. You get 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. That's stitchfix.com/majority for 25% off when you keep everything in your fix. stitchfix.com/majority. And folks, it's very difficult to these days to sort of like, you know, figure out how you can interact with people without it being a screen. Well, one of my solutions, at least with my child, anyways, and I by child, I mean, she's, a teenager. She's a grown person. The way she talks is sometimes a little bit disturbing. But Hunt a Killer is a new game, a new way to do game night. It gives you the opportunity to have fun, work together, investigate a crime without ever having to leave the house. Hunt a Killer reinvents the way we interact with murder mysteries. So you're not sitting on your couch watching True Detective on HBO or whatever it is, or listening to some podcast about a murder. You become an investigator. It's like a murder mystery subscription box. It has over 2,000 5-star reviews on Trustpilot. What happens is that they send you a new box each month. You have documents in there, evidence. Sometimes it's audio recordings that they put on a little thumb drive. There's case files, pictures. And you use all this to crack the case. They even have like a spoiler-free online community if you want to go there. I will not allow Mila to do that because we must discuss it. That's the whole point. I know there's other people who do it a different way, but it's been great. It's a great way to connect with people. In my experience, it's also a great way to get your kid off of a device. She came to me and she's like, I'm obsessed with the Law and Order, that Dick Wolf show. And I didn't have the heart to say like, really? But I mean, I guess people like that. I don't know. But and when I told her we could get this, she was super psyched. And so it's been fun. We had our bulletin board too going for a while. Right now, you know, the one with the strings. Right now, just for our listeners, you can go to huntakiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority at checkout for 20% off your first box. Head to huntakiller.com/majority for 20% off. Show your support for our podcast. That's huntakiller.com/majority. All right. Again, we will put links to all of our ads in our podcast description and our YouTube description. And if you are a member of the show, you'll hear my voice now because we just cut out the commercials for you. But if you guys, members, want to see what deals we have for stuff, make sure you always check out the podcast description, YouTube description. You can get those deals. And now it is my pleasure to welcome back to the show. And by welcome back to the show, well, by to the show, I mean every iteration of this program over the course of 16 years now. Holy crap. It's my pleasure to welcome the co-founder of the Baffler magazine, author of What's the Matter Kansas, Wrecking Crew, Listen Liberal, and his latest, The People Know, A Brief History of Populism, Thomas Frank. Welcome back to the program.
So it looks like he's still kind of connecting. I'm not sure if we can... Oh, here we go.
Thomas, are you there?
I'm here.
There we go.
Can you see me?
We cannot see you.
Okay.
Ah, I can see you now.
How about
How's
now?
It going? We can see you.
Thomas, Mr. Sam Cedar.
Welcome back to the program. It's great to see you.
Yeah. Hey, it's been a while. How are you?
It has been a while, but I was just saying that I think the first time that we spoke was 16 years ago with What's the Matter with Kansas on,
yes,
on a different iteration of this program.
Yes, and a different iteration of my like one idea that I have, you know, been obsessively hitting and hitting again all my life.
Well, you know,
to no avail, I should
I was gonna say, you know, it's tough. And I have moments where I'm like 16 years and I got to say net, I don't see things necessary.
You don't see a win for Kid Frank?
Well, I mean, you and me both. But I do. Let me put it this way. And I hate to use this is I use this term only facetiously, but the sentiment's true. I do see some green shoots. Let's put it that way.
Oh, stop it.
But we'll get to that in a moment.
Wasn't that what Larry Summers said about the economy?
It was like Larry Summers.
2009 or something.
And we see that with Kudlow, too. Said
oh, my God. Oh, my God.
But
Kudlow. Right. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about – I want to let's get into the history, and then I want to talk about the broader take because in some respects – you have been making this argument for at least 16 years anyways, and it has more resonance. And in some ways, it's become a little more controversial, it seems to me, on the left on some ways.
Yeah.
But we'll get there. Let's just start with the people know. And I should say, for people who can't see, N-O. You got the book right there. That should be on your bookshelf.
I showed it.
You know that, right? That's.
Yeah, I'm kind of a.
Right
I'm kind of a.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, that's good. Maybe you need a bigger version of it, though. It gets. But all right. So the people know.
This I wrote play. This tiny little book here, Sam. Here it is.
It's
real small.
Than
your you
hand.
Can read. You can read it so fast. It's
like
so
those little
small.
Red books that the Black Panthers sell in Berkeley.
Yeah, yeah. I remember those. They were very cheaply printed. Do you remember that? I think they were printed in China or something and brought
yes,
over by the
they
boatload.
Were. They were. All right. Well, so the title is a play on a Carl Sandburg book, which was actually like a book length poem.
Yeah. I've got it here.
Tell us about that. He's going to actually show us, folks.
He actually is, yeah.
He's going to keep referencing, yeah.
I do this. I'm constantly pulling books off the shelf to show. This is Zoom. It's like, you know, welcome to my office, Sam.
There you go.
I've got all the books. They're all right here, damn it.
All right, but why? So why? What?
Carl
what,
Sandburg, why he, you know, it's just one of the great all-time statements of faith in ordinary people. So it was published in 1936, the great, you know, the decade of the common man. This was the period when America was more in love with democracy and average people than, you know, any other time in our history. And also, not coincidentally, it was a time of great success for the left, such as it is or was. I mean, I don't know what you say anymore, but
right.
You know, the labor movement was growing by leaps and bounds. I think it tripled in size in the course of the decade. Franklin Roosevelt was in the White House. Social Security got done. You know, all of these emergency measures to give people jobs during the Depression. He broke up the banks, regulated Wall Street. I mean, the stuff that they did then, it's you know, it's heroic, and it's somewhat sad to me that it's slowly fading from memory. But you know, it's what they did is just it puts modern day politics to shame. Anyhow,
great period to do things, right? I mean,
get stuff done. But also their attitude towards ordinary people in this country, to bring it back to Carl Sandburg, it's a viewpoint that we have a lot of trouble understanding or replicating here in our own day. We liberals, we're so suspicious of those, you know, Trump voters out in the red states, you know, that it's very hard for us to write something like that. The people, yes. And so when I say the people know, I'm not, that's not my attitude. That's the attitude of the people I'm trying to describe, this long history of anti-populism in America.
So, all right. So let's go back and just talk a little bit about the history of populism. And I guess maybe institutionalized populism starts with you in Kansas and your home state. 1890s.
All of my writing starts in Kansas.
Yeah, of course.
although I'm joining you now from suburban Washington, D.C. I was in Kansas until a few weeks ago. I was out there visiting my dad, who is 91 years old. But that's neither here nor there. Populism, the word, it's not – this is what I want to drive home to your viewers, is that it's not just a word that – you know, that comes down to us from the Latin or something, and we can just use it however we want. I mean, we can do whatever, you know, it's language. You can do whatever you want. But the word was consciously invented in the year 1891 by a bunch of Kansas politicians riding on a train between Kansas City and Topeka. And they were trying to think up a name for supporters of this left-wing third-party movement that they had launched and that had started off with a huge bang in the state of Kansas and also in a bunch of other states on the Great Plains. And the word was, of course, populism, and that's what the party came – its formal name was the People's Party, but it came to be known as the Populist Party. Till by the end, that's people didn't even know that it had – you know, and another name. That's just what they called it, the populist. The word was an enormous success right from the very start. One of the I have a lot of, as you no doubt have seen, a lot of humorous illustrations in the book, but one of them that I didn't include is a newspaper in this tiny little town in Kansas. And this is a few days after the word was invented on this train ride. And this newspaper puts it in a huge headline, the word populist, ! Are you a populist? It says underneath. And it goes on and on about, you know, and then it just reprints a whole lot of, you know, People's Party, you know, falderal, sort of the usual workerist stuff that they would always, you know, but they knew that the word was a winner right from the start, that they had come up with something good.
And so what was the Populist Party, People's Party plank at that time. I mean, platform. I mean,
what were they about?
They were like an ascendant. They were like an ascendant third party. I mean, and they moved very quickly. I mean, I think in that election, or maybe it was in 1892, they won four states, I think it was.
Yeah, they won a bunch of states. They're the last third party to do that. And they also elected governors. We had more than one populist governor in Kansas. They had members of the House of Representatives. They had U.S. senators, you know, mayors, et cetera, et cetera. And by the way, all over the country, it wasn't just on the Great Plains. They did not do very well in the Northeast, but they did very well out in the West. They had the mayor of San Francisco at one point was a populist, and the South was the place where it was most fiercely contested. They fought hard in the South, but they lost, which I assume we'll talk about it later on, with like dreadful ramifications that lasted for decades. But it was a left-wing party. Mainly it came out of – the idea was to bring together all the economic reform groups of the time. But the main group that was behind it was called the Farmers Alliance. It was like the Farmers Union that still exists today. It was an enormous – you know, farmers were more than half the population at the time. It was an enormous group. It had millions and millions and millions of members. They came together with labor unions. The Knights of Labor were part of this. A couple of others, the United Mine Workers, were in it. That sort of thing, and set up this party. And the things that they believed in, they wanted federal farm programs. They wanted regulation of banks. They wanted the government to break up monopolies. They wanted the government to nationalize the railroads. They wanted to get us off the gold standard. This was very, very important to them. They were the currency was a huge issue in the 1890s in a way that it is not anymore. And then a bunch of other things that they didn't emphasize as much, but they wanted a whole bunch of political reforms, the secret ballot. They wanted votes for women, things like that right down the line. And so they were regarded for many decades. As you mentioned, their life came and went very quickly.
Yep.
In the space of about 6 or 7 years, they rose up and then disappeared. And after that, for historians in the early part of the 20th century, looked back at populism as a great moment. This was the predecessor of the New Deal. This is where so many of the big reform ideas got started. And then we can talk about what happened after that.
Yeah, I want to give me a sense, though. I'm also, you know, and part of this is just sort of like my most recent fascination. Like, you know, how did that develop? Sort of coming out of Reconstruction, you had the radical Republicans, which went really, in many respects, were there were some changes. You know, like things like post office and you know, public schools.
Yes,
but largely thwarted by Johnson, and then
you're talking about in the South here.
Yeah, well, I'm just talking broadly speaking in terms of Reconstruction. Like, where does this come from out of that? What was the sort of preceding event? Because when I look at, when we talk about, and we're going to get up to the New Deal, that newfound, I guess, love or embracing of people that you were talking about, which in many respects was also like, there was also a certain amount of fear involved in that too, because people had just taken a beating. Broadly speaking, the people had just taken a beating. Like, I wonder, like, you know, what was happening in the 1880s or in the 1870s, coming out of the wake of the Civil War, that sort of put us in a position where this movement would catch fire so quickly.
Okay. Well, the main thing is that it was hard times for farmers, and they were, like I said, it's more than half of the population of the country, and they are on their way down economically. Farm prices drop and drop and drop every year. And these stories, the Farmers Alliance, like I said, had been going for some time before they went into politics. And the idea of the Farmers Alliance was that if farmers got together, and remember, these are the people at the very bottom of the social hierarchy of this country, the lowest rank of mankind. And, you know, dirt farmers, family farmers, and a lot of places they're tenant farmers, especially in the South. So sharecroppers. And these are, And the Farmers Alliance said, we're going to get together, we're going to learn about why our situation is so bad, and then we're going to take collective action. And they did the education part of that pretty well. They blanketed the country with pamphlets. By the way, and when you research this in the state archives and stuff, you read their pamphlets. You know, they produced these in enormous numbers, pamphlets explaining to farmers why their situation was so bad. And a lot of it had to do with currency deflation,
right?
Because the gold standard, the problem with a gold standard when you have like a situation like the 1880s and 1890s is there's not a lot of gold in the world, and there's not a lot of gold in the United States, and the amount of gold doesn't increase a lot every year. But at the same time, the economy was growing enormously. I mean, this is the great period of American capitalism, and the population is growing because of immigration, and the currency is not. And so what this makes for is deflation. So you, if you are someone who borrows money, this is particularly devastating because you borrow money and you have to pay it back a couple of years later, and it's worth a lot more. It has gone up in value. And so this was really, really bad for debtors. And farmers are a debtor class.
I want to make sure people understand this dynamic because you have an increase in demand, right? Because there's more people.
More people.
And there's more economic activity.
Right. Money, but the currency does not, right.
And there is, they can't print more money.
Right. Because on the gold standard.
It's tied to gold.
Right.
And so, money becomes more expensive in some way. It's harder
to get that money. So when you measure it against your crops or something like that, so measure it against, say, wheat. So when you borrow the money, it's worth, you know, 5 bushels of wheat. When you have to pay it back, it's worth 10.
Right.
Okay. So this is a recipe for disaster for farmers and for a lot of other groups as well.
Right. It's and exactly so they, why, you know, and
why we eventually did get off the gold.
We don't have
the gold standard anymore.
Right. And that's why we can, and you know, that's a separate sort of modern monetary.
Yeah. Yeah. But
theory.
The populists were way, way ahead of the rest of us on that particular question. But what's funny is they were just slammed for it at the time. They were regarded as cranks, as anti-intellectuals, because every economist in the world believed in the gold standard. And here's these people out on the Great Plains saying, you know, the gold standard is a bad thing. And it's like blasphemy, you know, to say something like that. And as we'll get into this in a minute.
But and it's motivated reasoning too, because if I'm a banker and I
yeah, the
money,
gold standard rocks.
Right.
If you're a banker or a lender or, you know, whatever, you have a lot of money, that money, it's becoming more valuable every year.
That's right.
Yes.
And so I lend you $10 today. And like you say, that $10 can buy me a bushel of wheat. But when you pay it back to me, I can buy 10 bushels of wheat with it or whatever,
right.
Whatever the dynamic is.
Exactly. Okay. So bankers and basically the Eastern establishment in general, you know, not to mention the rest of the world, the British Empire ran on the gold standard. This was accepted all over the world. And here's these cranks out in farm country saying no. And you can imagine what the reaction was. Anyhow, so that's the background. The Farmers Alliance tried to find a solution for the problem that was not political. For various reasons, they didn't want to go into politics. Well, I mean, you can guess why. People in the South were Democrats. People in the North were Republicans. They didn't all share political views. So they said, we'll try to solve our problems they built a cooperative. They were really into farm co-ops. I don't know. If you're from farm country, you know what this is. They were really into that. Well, that didn't work. And so after trying all of these different methods, they said, look, the only way we can save our livelihoods is by going into politics. And this mass movement, millions and millions of people, went into politics in the year 1890, and with a huge bang in the state of Kansas, they won the state legislature in a very short amount of time, beat the local Republican Party. Kansas was a one-party state then, as it still is today. And the populists very briefly threw these guys out. And then it took off from there, and it was growing by leaps and bounds. Oh, you wanted to know about Reconstruction and about the South. And so the South, obviously a rural economy, a lot of farmers, almost everyone was a farmer in the South. And populism was obviously very attractive there. And they did a really interesting thing in the South. So the Populist Party had a black contingent. They were, historians call them the Black Populists. And the up until then in the South, you know, this is well 20 years after Reconstruction. Reconstruction is over, but in a lot of places, blacks could still vote in the South at the time. And the South was dominated by the Democratic Party, what they used to call the Bourbon Democrats, very conservative Democrats who were also the local ruling elite, the bankers, the railroad owners, et cetera. And they, the way they solidified their hold on the South, the way they kept in power was through a doctrine they called white solidarity, which is that the idea that white people have that their interests as whites is more important than their interests as, say, workers or farmers or whatever, that they have to stick together, you know, and vote for whoever the white leadership says is the, you know, is the candidate. And hence, the, and so that way, in that way, the Democratic Party retained its control of the South. The populists came along and said, well, you know, we have a different proposal to make, which is we think that the white farmers' interests are, you know, the farmer's, his interest as a farmer is more important than his interest as a white person. And as a matter of fact, his interests as a farmer are really similar to the interests of black farmers. And therefore, we're going to reach out to black voters and say, you know, let's build a coalition based on class interest rather than on racial interest. And this was, now I'm not saying here that they were like racially enlightened or anti-racist in a modern day sense. They weren't. They were not like us today, but they were able to understand this. This was real simple, you right. know. It's like no matter what you think about black people, they're in the same boat as you economically, and if you get together with them politically, you can change things. And this caught on. Now, this, you can imagine the controversy. This was extremely controversial, and it was so upsetting to the Bourbon Democrats of the South that they used all sorts of every tool at their disposal to ensure that populism didn't win across the South. And they, I mean, they shot people. They, you know, they both sides fought with each other. And but the Bourbon Democrats kept winning. There's only one Southern state where the populists came out on top, and that was North Carolina. And they, anyhow, it's a long story, but it ended in an absolute stunning disaster. Do you want to hear the story?
Yes.
So in North Carolina, they got together with the local Republican Party. The South was a one-party region, Democratic, but the Republicans still existed in a few places. And in North Carolina, they were still around. And most black voters in North Carolina were loyal to the Republican Party. And so the populists made a deal with the Republicans and said, let's get together and we'll beat the Democrats. And they did it. And they actually won. And they took over the state legislature. They elected the governor. They elected a U.S. senator, et cetera. And they put various measures in place that allowed local control, which meant that black, in places where blacks were in the majority, they could elect, you know, aldermen and stuff like this. And the white Democrats went absolutely berserk. And this, you see this, by the way, this is always the story of populism in those days, that the elites, whoever they are, just go nuts. Hysteria ensues. And they, in 1898, they decided to beat populism down using the only weapon, the only real weapon they had at their disposal, which is what white supremacy. And they actually called it the White Supremacy Campaign and, you know, ran on this hysterical campaign of racist hatred and fear. And in this way, succeeded in beating populism in North Carolina and beating the Republicans. And the first thing the new white supremacy legislature did once they had beaten these guys was disenfranchise blacks and poor whites. And they did this actually all across the South. All the Southern states at this time disenfranchised blacks and a lot of poor whites. And the reason in every state was always the same was either to keep populism from ever happening again, or to keep something like populism. In some states, it was delayed by 5 or 6 years, so populism was already gone. But they always disenfranchised blacks and poor whites with the same idea, that you've got to make sure that something like this never happens again.
So, there was also, and just like to talk about the success of that time. They had the populace made a similar alliance with the, with Jenning, right?
Yeah. With the National Democrats. Yeah.
And my understanding is that Tom Watson, who you write about, was almost going to be the VP.
Well, that was the idea. He's a very interesting guy because he kind of went nuts later on after his life really went bad, you know, and he famously went a little crazy, but we'll talk about him in a minute. So the way the story of populism climaxed and then, collapsed is that, here's this party that is growing and growing, and there's a terrible depression in the 1890s. And, you know, there's enormous strikes. The Pullman strike happens. The Homestead strike happens. There's a protest march on Washington, the first one ever. Populists organize it. It was called Coxey's Army. These unemployed people went to Washington and protested. And it looks like populism is the coming force in American politics. Its numbers are growing. They're electing people from more states. They're reaching out into the big cities. They run, a very formidable slate in Chicago. They're trying their best in Ohio, you know, things like this. And 1896 comes along, presidential election year. There's a Democrat president in the White House. It's Grover Cleveland. But he is essentially no different than the Republicans, except for on, like, you know, some very moderate issues. But he believes in the gold standard. He's very conservative. He's the one that sent federal troops into Chicago to put down the Pullman strike. You know, he's a very conservative Democrat, essentially no different from the Republicans. And the Democrats meet in their convention in Chicago and basically throw Cleveland and the gold standard and all the rest of it, just throw them to the winds and nominate this guy, William Jennings Bryan, 36 years old, a one-term congressman from Nebraska. And they nominate this guy for president on the strength of a speech that he has given denouncing the gold standard, you know, attacking the gold standard. And, you know, this is the famous Cross of Gold speech. Yep. He says, "You will not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns," you know, comparing them to the crucifixion of Jesus. "You will not crucify mankind upon this cross of gold," meaning the gold standard. And the convention erupts that he's the most amazing thing they've ever seen, and they nominate him for president. And the populists, about a month later, actually just a few weeks later, they say, "Well, you know, Bryan, he talks like us. A lot of them know him because he's from Nebraska." They say, "You know, he's a good guy. He's not with us on all our other issues. And in fact, the Democrats have given us no end of hell in the South, but he's with us on this one big issue." So they decide to cross endorse him. The populists are going to throw in their lot with the Democratic Party at the national level. And if he wins, you know, they figure they'll be able to name some members of the cabinet or something like that. And they will be, you know, they will have achieved success in a very short amount of time. So it's alluring. And they sign up, they get on board. And instead of winning, you know, everybody thinks at first Bryan is this man of destiny with this amazing oratorical power, et cetera. And he goes on the whistle stop tour. I think it's the first one ever. You know, he just goes around the country giving speeches, and the Republicans just unleash against him the most incredible campaign of villainy and infamy, you know, that this country has ever seen. They outraise and outspend him something like 20 or 30 to 1. We don't really know because they didn't report, you know, they kept the records, but we don't know what they were. And they crushed him in this amazing campaign of 1896, a sort of proto Karl Rove, a guy called Mark Hanna, who managed William McKinley's campaign.
Right.
And we'll talk about that in a minute, because the details of it, I spend a lot of time on the details of it, because they're quite amusing and they're also very telling for the present day. But when Bryan goes down, populism goes down with him, and the People's Party, they set to argue. They start arguing with each other. They break into factions, and before the 1897 is over, they basically don't exist anymore. They're through as a national party. Now, you asked about Tom Watson.
Yeah, I mean, that guy, I mean, that is, because, we'll get to this later, but, Watson's trajectory is, he went from someone who was, it seems to me, very explicit, like, black farmer, white farmer, you guys,
let's get together, we can win. Yeah, that's what he said.
The farmer is the operative term there.
Yeah.
And then within, and at one point he was going to be, they were hoping to get him to be Jennings, Brian's running
VP.
Man.
Yep. And he's a classic example of, he was also very young and weirdly talented. Historians, by the way, just so you know, are fascinated by Watson because he's the classic example of someone, of a reformer going wrong. Although there's many other examples,
right,
of course, but he, what happened is, he was, in some ways the populists' most fiery leader. He's the one he wrote a famous article about the race question and how, what was called the race question at the time, how the populist party would settle it. And the way they'd settle it is exactly what you just said. They would reach out to black farmers and win their votes. And that was, and then he ran for Congress in Georgia. He almost certainly won, but the local Democrats cheated him, as they always did back then. And so he never got to take office. He had been in Congress as a Democrat before all this began. But he saw his career just be completely destroyed by the Southern Democrats. And after the campaign is over in 1896, and he's just humiliated nationally. I mean, Bryan won't even meet with him. The populists say to William Jennings Bryan, okay, the price of us endorsing you is you have to accept our guy for VP. And Bryan just ignores them. So he's just humiliated in all these different ways. And he sort of goes silent for a while. And he emerges from this silence a couple years later as the country's foremost racist. And he becomes this incredibly ferocious hater of blacks. And, the very people that he had been trying to reach out to a few years previously. And like I say, historians are fascinated by this, about, what goes wrong with this guy's personality and how does this happen? What does this tell you about him? What does this tell you about the movement? And ultimately what you conclude is it doesn't say a whole lot about the movement, because this is one guy,
right,
who is doing this stuff. And by the time he claims the name populist, by the way, and clings to this, up into like 1904. But by that time, he's the only one left. There's nobody, all the other, like the populists from Kansas have all gone back to the Republicans, or they've gone back to the Socialist Party. This is Eugene Debs, who's
right,
another populist leader, becomes a socialist leader, et cetera, et cetera. But here's Watson still going. And, he has no followers to speak of. And he becomes the nation's leading racist. And then at some point, and he goes from bad to worse. He starts running this newspaper. And anyhow, he encourages lynch mobs. There's these terrible incidents. And they finally, he makes his peace with the Democratic Party. They run him for the U.S. Senate, and he wins. And he ends his life as a U.S. senator from Georgia, as a Democrat. This, like, viciously racist, anti-Semitic Democrat.
And what it raises to me, I mean, there's a couple of things about Watson that I find sort of fascinating, and it had come across him over the years because he's had this dramatic, like, my question is populism, and this, I'm getting ahead of myself, but a little bit, but we can have this conversation here on some level too, is populism a tactic, or is it an ideology, or is it a disposition? I mean, that is because I think Watson ends up being sort of some of the basis for smearing populism.
Oh yeah, no, that's exactly right. And so later on in the 1950s, when historians turn against populism, Watson is always their example of, look, this movement, one of its leaders became this awful person. But just so you know, his biographer was a guy called C. Van Woodward. And Woodward never thought that, I mean, wrote the classic biography of Tom Watson. Woodward never thought that because Watson, you know, degenerated into this racist, he didn't think that that reflected poorly on the populist movement. He thought that this was that the populist movement in the early 1890s, when it was growing and making its outreach and stuff, that this was a very hopeful moment. This was, right. You know, this is a great moment. But there's this larger question, and I don't want to brush it off, about what happens when progressives lose and they get frustrated and they turn bitter. And you and I have been around long enough. I know people like this.
Me too. Me too.
I know people who are Trump supporters now, you know, who have turned so, I mean, people that used to be on the left with me in the 90s and have grown so bitter by their frustration at the hands of whoever, however you want to put it, the Democratic Party, the politically correct, that they have gone in a terrible, terrible, terrible direction.
Well, that is what interests me about this, like with, you know, and I think my thinking has evolved a little bit in this respect, is that, like, that's what brings me to this question about populism. Is it a tactic? Is it a disposition? Is it an ideology? Like, because if it's a tactic, it can be adorned.
It can be swiped by Trump.
Trump.
I get it. Yeah.
By Watson.
So I would say no, that it's, I mean, I don't know what you mean by ideology, but what my meaning of it would be, this is the American version of the Labour Party in England or the Labour Party in Australia. The Labour Party in Australia, actually, at one point, they all started at the same time. The Labour Party in Australia considered calling itself the People's Party, just out of homage to what then looked like a promising movement in the United States. And all the social democratic parties in Europe are starting up at the same time. This is, populism is part of that. And I take my definition, and by the way, my definition is strictly an American one, but my definition of lowercase p populism is a transracial movement of working class people for social democracy. And in American history, it flowers in the 1930s. This is really the great period for it. And we started off talking about Carl Sandburg, which is a kind of cultural populism. And there's many other examples of that. The movies of Frank Capra, you know, almost any World War II movie. You know? And at the same time, the labor movement. And at the same time, Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal is happening. And that's, for me, that is the great populist period of American life.
But that is not transracial, per se. I mean, is it? I mean,
well, the CIO certainly. Well, I mean, the CIO, which is the main labor organizing sort of umbrella group at the time, was militantly transracial, militantly anti-racist by the standards of the 1930s. Probably the most anti-racist white group, anyway, that there was in America. I mean, without a doubt. And you think of people like Paul Robeson, who, you know, sang this incredible song, Ballad for Americans, which is in some ways, you know, this great musical version of American populism, which is, you know, explicitly anti-racist. You know, so yeah, that was, again, they weren't on the same, they weren't anti-racist by our modern day standards. They weren't as enlightened as we are today, but by the standards of the time, yeah, they were very much so.
So what, I mean, I guess, and we'll bump up to,
And you got to also remember the anti-populists, the other part of the story, the anti-populists of the 30s and of the 1890s were incredibly racist, just like off the scale racist. Right. Like when they would attack Roosevelt, I did not realize this. I never read this anywhere, Sam, until I did the research for this book, how racist the anti-Roosevelt movement was. It wasn't just they were into eugenics. I mean, they were fascist. And this is big business in America. These are important corporation lawyers in America, economists in America. They were part of this sort of fascist current coming out of Europe, you know. But thank God for in this country, at least, we were on the right side of all those questions. You know, while we were celebrating the common man in this country, and our people were writing books like The People, yes. While the Europeans were writing, Revolt of the Masses,
right.
and Oswald Spengler, this kind of thing.
I want to ask you about that era too, because one thing that I found really interesting was the, I don't know if you would call it patriotism or like the Americanism that was embraced by the populace at that time. And I wonder if like what happened to that, because on some level it feels like the American
claiming the symbols,
imperialism sort of start to undercut that, and the notion of internationalism on the left undercut that sort of like, I don't know what you would call it, patriotism.
No, people do call it. They call it Americanism. This phenomenon in the 30s, when you have labor unions, immigrant groups, and stuff like that, claiming the symbols of America, the flag. I mean, the labor movement and the flag, and claiming the founding fathers and identifying themselves with American democracy. And often, I mean, let's admit it, in a way that to the modern ear sounds pretty schmaltzy, you know?
I mean, I think that type of jingoism, like, you know, like...
Well, it wasn't jingoism at the time, but it can blend into that.
Jingoism,
yeah, so right? Like Michael Kazin has written about this, that this 30s sensibility, which you see, in these beautiful, like, WPA murals celebrating the American people, that does blend into Cold War, into the sort of really unfortunate jingoism of the Cold War and also of our own time. And that is really unfortunate. But that's also because, look, the good guys have been beaten. It's a complicated story, but these symbols, I would say, are always contested. And just because, assholes have them at the moment doesn't mean that we can't take them back.
Do you think we should? I mean, I think that is like,
hell yes.
I'll say this because we drive around and I drive around with my daughter. She's 15. She is, I don't know where she got it, but she is vehemently anti-Trump and she is.
Well, why not? Come on.
Of course. I'm being facetious, but I'm struck by like, if she sees somebody flying an American flag, her first reaction is like, ooh. And I'm like, I don't chide her. I interrogate her a little bit about it, but it occurs to me that maybe it was during Vietnam, but that notion of populism, because I don't think you can have a populist movement without some embracing of at least the ambitions of America. And I think there's many on the left who, and I'm talking maybe from a tactical standpoint, right? Like, I mean, I'm also pretty jaded, but I'm trying not to be at times. But I'm talking just from a purely a tactical standpoint. You need to embrace some of that Americana. You cannot react like my 15-year-old daughter does. We're driving by. She's like, ooh.
Sam, and you and I are on exactly the same page. I fly the American flag. I'm extremely patriotic.
But you have to balance it and be like,
of course. Well, think about, look, Thomas Jefferson, for God's sakes. I went to the University of Virginia and he's the only one of the founding fathers that even remotely believed in democracy. This is the man that wrote the Declaration of Independence. I learned when I was down there, I did a tour of Monticello a few years ago. He wrote the Declaration of Independence on a desk carved for him by a slave. It's incredibly difficult and problematic to pick your way through it.
Right.
That a man could be both great and awful at the same time. And that is troubling. And it's easy to just wash your hands of the whole thing and say, well, to hell with that. I don't even want to think about it. And maybe we need to choose different heroes from our past. I'm fine with that too.
Thomas Paine's up
yeah,
there.
Yeah, Paine's a great one. Franklin Roosevelt. Come on, Carl Sandburg. Why not?
Right.
And many, many others. Paul Robeson. We mentioned him. Great, great man. And maybe we need to do that, but we've still got to have continuity with the past, and we've got to have connections with the American people. What I know will not work is a liberalism that is just about expertise and white collar meritocracy, you know, and being at the top of the hierarchy and ordering everybody else to do as we say. And I know that won't work. By the way, we were talking earlier, we started the show talking about what I've been saying for 20 years. You know, I was a great believer in Obama when he got elected. I think you were as well. I was very enthusiastic about it.
I had my hopes up when the Reverend Wright tape came out. I started getting a little more hopeful, frankly. But I'm quite convinced he was. I now believe that he was never sitting in those pews and that he did not hear that.
Well, I think about it all the time because for me it was a real turning point because George Bush was very similar to Trump in a lot of ways, like appointed these incompetents to run everything in Washington, you know, these fools. And here comes Obama. I had met Obama. He was a professor at the University of Chicago where I went to graduate school. Very intelligent. And he brought in a cabinet of people much like him, very intelligent people. Hell, the president of Harvard, Larry Summers.
Right.
And these very, very intelligent people proceeded to like continue the bailout policies of the Bush administration and to do all the other, you know, all the sort of half measures that he did, you know, to deliver this version of universal health care that's really no universal health care at all.
Right.
You know, and not do anything about Wall Street. Inequality continues. Everything continues. Deindustrialization. He doesn't, you know, the trade agreements. He doesn't do anything. And for me, that is a huge point, an inflection point where you have to ask yourself as a liberal, like, what is this? You know, why do these? And I think I finally brought it to an answer with this new book, that this form of liberalism is about elites making decisions for us. It is about, you know, the highly educated, you know, coming together in a cabinet like Obama and sitting around a table and agreeing with one another and coming to consensus decisions with one another. And it doesn't work. And what does work, and here I am completely flipping the 1950s script, what does work is populism. What works is mass movements of working class people in the street. What works is things like the Farmers Alliance, the Populist Party, the CIO in the 1930s, the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. Enormous protest movements of working class people organized explicitly around issues of concern to working class people. That works. That gets results.
Well, I mean, it's but short-lived in some way, right?
I mean, the labor movement still exists, Sam. These guys are it's still out there. It just is. It has no energy. It has no vital spark
right
anymore. You know, but it's we all know why it's there and what its role should be, and that it should be growing by leaps and bounds. These things are all out there simmering under the surface. You saw Black Lives Matter, 100,000 people in the streets. This is extraordinary. Now, it's not a populist movement per se yet because it's not about the economic issues. Populism is focused, zoomed in on the economic issues. But Black Lives Matter could become that. It could happen very quickly. And if it did, it would be unstoppable.
I mean, I think we end up on the same place. There was one point, I guess, I don't think I've ever named who said this to me, but I might as well just say it now. He's so out of politics now. But at one point I got invited to Elliot Spitzer's, one of his Christmas parties. I have a feeling they had multiple ones, when I was going to be a regular on his CNN show before that fell.
I was on his show a lot. By the way, he was one of the very few that was interested in what I was saying.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is that I think, you know, it's unfortunate because he very much, I think, was, I suspect FDR was very much a model that he was following. I mean, you know, FDR wasn't the technocrat necessarily that Obama was, but and I remember distinctly asking him, and this must have been about 2010. We were at this Christmas party, and so he was a little bit drunk, and I think he was a little bit looser than he would have been. I certainly was.
Watch out, Mr. Sater.
And he said, "I said, why is he pivoting to austerity?" And
you meaning
Obama. And because that was really the
moment. Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
embraced what was it called? The grand bargain. Oh my god! Right. I mean, oh, did that make me mad? Oh.
He had shown himself a little bit when he wouldn't do the cram down in 2009, and the
stimulus package was way too small. Do you remember that?
Way too small. Yes, it was.
He had opportunity in his hands.
Yes,
and it was a huge
wasted opportunity.
Yeah,
and I asked him, and Spitzer shared this same frustration. I mean, he said he has surrounded himself with people and he thinks they know what they're talking about. And he said, and Spitzer said this to me, I'll never forget. He goes, I know these people. I went to Princeton with them and they were all C students and they cheated at tennis. And I just thought, like, this is a class traitor.
Yeah.
That I'm here with.
Yeah.
I mean, he still has the coach mounts. And, but this is a guy who, because he grew up with these people, realizes that they are full of shit. Excuse me. And
are you allowed to say that on the TV?
I am. Yeah. You're not. No, of course. Yeah, you can't. But that he is full, that they are full of shit in that Obama, he said, I think something to the effect of, like, because he grew up, you know, sort of fighting to get into that class, did not realize he thought that they deserved to be there.
Yeah. Well, it's a very typical attitude of someone who has succeeded by dint of educational, you know, Obama's real smart, did well on his tests, went to Columbia, went to Harvard Law. You know, like Clinton before him had, you know, been trained to think of the meritocracy as legitimate.
Yes.
This is the great fallacy of our
era. Because it worked for him.
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's, you
exactly.
let a couple of people
exactly.
up and they.
But that's one of the great things about Roosevelt. I mean, you brought up Franklin Roosevelt. And one of the lessons that I take from the 30s that I always repeat to people, because nobody is aware of this, they look back at Roosevelt as the beginning of government by expert, but it wasn't really. Had he really appointed the Larry Summerses of his day, the leading authorities on economics, his administration would have been the Hoover administration. It was the same crap. The economists of his day signed these joint letters. You know how they love to do this? Like 230 economists demand. They did this denouncing Roosevelt and denouncing the New Deal. The orthodox economics of the 1930s absolutely despised Franklin Roosevelt, as did the orthodox lawyers of the time. This is the anti-populist hysteria of the 1930s that I write about in the book. This, by the way, this hysteria, we didn't get to talk about this, but this hysteria recurs throughout American history. You have episodes of hysteria. And the one in the 1930s is particularly fascinating. You know, all these corporation attorneys, and you see the rise of the first great right-wing front group. It was called the American Liberty League, funded by the DuPont family and a couple other very, very wealthy families. And they had more money than the Republican Party in 1936. And they would put on speakers on national radio hookups, editorials in the newspapers, et cetera, often denouncing the New Deal constantly, but often on really racist grounds, you know, because it was allowing people to succeed who did not deserve to succeed. Why did they not deserve to succeed? Because they were from poor stock. You know, they were at the bottom because they were supposed to be at the bottom, you know, in this sort of social Darwinist view of the world. Really extraordinary stuff. And what's funny is that anybody like the DuPont family, these are intelligent people, that anybody thought this is how you win an election in America. You know, they went down to this crushing defeat, you know, outspending Roosevelt by an enormous margin. All the newspapers in America are on the side of the Republican candidate, Alf Landon, and he loses. He only won two states in 1936.
But in some ways, they've won now. Right.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, this
well, they've
year,
learned. I mean, so the right wingers learned, you know, the sort of descendants of the DuPont of that effort, you know, the Koch brothers and stuff like that have learned you don't attack people by saying, get back in your place. That's not how you respond. You respond by saying, the way Reagan did, the way Trump did, I am your friend. I am, you know, a man of the people. You know, I have this folksy attitude. You know, look at my unvarnished way of speaking, you know, and then you pass the Paul Ryan tax cuts, or in Reagan's case, the 81 tax cut. And meanwhile, the Democrats have in their folly, in their incredible ongoing 30 years and running folly, have decided that the way to fight back is to really double down on identifying themselves with the white collar educated elite and the wealthy suburbs and this kind of thing. Oh my God. I think they're going to win this fall, by the way. I think Biden deserves to win and will win. I mean, because Trump is, this is just, this man, his screw ups are just unimaginable at this point. By the way, well, I never asked you, how are you doing in this, our COVID?
Well, wait, I'm okay. But I agree with you that I think Biden's going to win because people are upset.
He doesn't deserve to, but he's going to. Trump
hasn't delivered. He hasn't delivered. And I want to remind everybody, Trump won with less votes than Romney lost with. Hillary Clinton was a bad candidate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, I don't want to litigate whether she's a good person or would have been a good president or any of that. She was a bad, deeply flawed candidate for a myriad of reasons, some which were, which were external to her, some which were internal, but that is the reality. I still contend that Martin O'Malley would have won. However,
that's actually probably true. Yeah.
However, the problem is with Biden is that 2022 looks very problematic. 2024 looks very problematic unless there is some addressing of the needs of the American public. And this
populism, there is genuine populism. And the thing is, I don't know if it can be delivered
populism,
from on high.
This is what I still is slippery to me. Is populism a set of policies? Because what do you call Donald Trump getting up there and being folksy. I mean, is it folksy?
I call it a sort of fake populism. You know, I've been writing about this since What's the Matter with Kansas? Right. And that's what I think it is. That's what I call it. It's not populism because there's no content to it. And he said the right thing on several issues. He, you know, I didn't vote for him and I can't stand him, but he did talk about the endless wars. I'm glad somebody talked about that.
Oh, no, totally. I agree with that.
And he did talk about what the damage done by the bad trade agreements. I'm glad he did that. But, you know, anybody can tell the guy's a liar.
Those are marginal. I mean, like, I mentioned this yesterday. There's a piece, I have it somewhere around here, from, I think it was, I don't know, maybe it was Forbes or something. Somebody went and talked to some construction workers in Ohio.
Yeah.
And they got a quote, and you know, it's one quote. You can find a quote from anybody, but the construction worker says, "I'm voting for Trump again because he fixed healthcare. He solved the trade deficit. We don't owe China as much money anymore. He balanced the budget."
Look, there's always misinformed voters out there.
But that's like, you know, when we go back on this history of the white supremacy campaign, you know, in North Carolina, like you talk about, with Jennings being crushed because of that Republican money. Like my point is that, like, you know, to build a lasting victory, you know, like what is that going, a sustaining victory? It seems to me that you get into office by hook or crook. It's, you know, Sanders could have won this year.
Okay. So I want to point out to you, Sam, something. I'm 55 years old. I thought the world that I was born into, the New Deal world with America as a middle-class society, America was, for white people in the North anyway, was a social democracy in 1965. In effect, you know, people had health insurance. You know, you would get paid well, et cetera. We didn't have a formal social democracy like they have in Europe, but we basically had that. And that's gone now. But when I was coming up in the 70s, I thought that was permanent. I thought that the middle class society was here to stay. And all that it required is that we would bring everybody in. Everybody would, you know, we would grow the middle class and, you know, and that would be it. And instead we did the opposite and we smashed it for everyone and, you know, made a handful of billionaires really, 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 really rich. And that's what we've done. But that sort of legacy of the New Deal, that survived for 40 years.
Yep.
Or 50 years, depending on how you look at it. That's impressive. It can be done. I just, you know, and yeah, winning little victories by hook or by crook, you know, that's one thing. But building a mass, look, for the right, that's been enough. Reagan beat Carter pretty soundly. But since then, they haven't won any great victories. George W. Bush did not beat Al Gore. You know, he won his second time around, but just barely. His dad, you know. Okay, so they won some victories, but they, regardless of whether they win or lose, or win massively or win slightly, they rule like they have an incredible mandate. Just look at the stuff Trump has done. I want to remind you of one more thing before we run out of time. The last 2 years of Obama's presidency, I used to write these articles saying, you know, remember, he didn't do anything the last 2 years. He did nothing. He just gave speeches. Yep. And I came up with a whole list of things that, because he didn't have Congress, right? I came up with a whole list of things that the president could do without Congress. For example, enforce antitrust. You know, the laws are already on the books. Just call in your attorney general and say, let's go get them. For example, go after universities for the tuition, you know, spiral, you know, or there's any number of things he could have done. There was an escape hatch on NAFTA. He could have renegotiated that unilaterally. All sorts of things that Obama could have done without Congress. But I remember at the time, there was this whole cheering section or choir, whatever you want to call it, among the pundit class. I call them the pundit bureau because they do everything together. And where ideas like mine were dismissed as magical thinking. Like we thought that Obama was some kind
Green
of
Green Lanternism.
Yes, that's
is
one
what
way.
It was.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
Green
and then,
Lanternism
yeah.
is what they would say. You think he has magical powers.
Yeah,
but in
it's
fact,
like, it's like, no, the antitrust laws are actually on the books. Trust me on this. Another one, laws against fraud. He could have prosecuted the Wall Street guys who were responsible for the crisis. He would have been a hero if he had done that. It doesn't take Congress to do that. It just takes some backbone.
Well, you know, only until Donald Trump came in.
But wait a minute. The worst case is this. It was a columnist for the New York Times. I can't remember which one. Actually wrote an article saying, you know, all of this is wrong because the presidency is actually, it doesn't have a lot of power. It's not a very powerful office. I think about that all the time. Every time Donald Trump does some incredible thing unilaterally, he suspended the payroll tax. For God's sakes, without Congress. And every time he does this, every time he deregulates something, every time he rolls something back or finds some clever way to force a foreign country into doing his bidding, I think about that article. You know, the presidency isn't really a very powerful
I,
all to get Obama off the hook. What the hell is wrong with the liberals? What the hell is wrong with us?
Well, I think there is a subset. I mean, I've just talked about Nancy Pelosi, and, you know, you can assess what she's doing either as just sheer incompetence, or it's not sheer incompetence. It's incompetence brought about by having an agenda that diverges from a lot of the people she purports to represent.
And so it looks
like incompetence. Yeah. But when you put in your messaging bill that we're going to subsidize COBRA instead of like anything else for health insurance, that's not incompetence. That is having a divergent agenda
that was the great line in Listen Liberal. It's like ultimately the reason Obama did what he did is because that's what he wanted to do.
Yep.
And you got to face it. You know, I regarded this man as a hero. I really admired him. I still admire him in a lot of ways. But he didn't want to do those things, you know. So, you know, he could have enforced antitrust. He could have gone after Google. It doesn't matter anymore. But look, the thing is that the expiration date is coming for this kind of liberalism. Biden might squeak by. I think he probably will this fall. I think Biden will be president. God damn it, they have got to rethink the entire direction of the party because Trumpism is not stopping.
Right.
Even if you defeat Trump, you're going to have another one. And the next one is not going to be quite as stupid.
I totally agree.
And look, Ted Cruz.
Right.
And as I have been saying, look, I've been saying this since What's the Matter with Kansas, and I'm sick of saying it. And in fact, I'm not saying it anymore. I am withdrawing from the political conversation after this year. I mean, I have other things to do, other projects to work on. And frankly, just between you and me, I can't wait to get back to work on them. I'm so sick of this crap.
I know it.
But I'm done telling them. It's like, you know, you tell them and they know what I say, you know, and I've been saying the same thing all these years. If they don't rediscover their origins as a populist party, as a party that, you know, the legacy of populism.
Who's the they, though? Are we just
the Democrats? But you're exactly right to say that, because, of course, you can't expect these changes to come from on high. You can't. You and I both know they have to come from the bottom up. And I don't know how you do that.
Well, that's the $64,000 question, right? I mean, or $64 or whatever it is.
Under the gold standard, $64.
I don't know if I mean it. To me, it's like, you know, I look towards, you know, like the Squad and the new members of Congress, and that is a nascent thing. And frankly, you and I are in the same generation, and I think people who are 20 years our junior have a very different, I mean, oddly enough, they have no connection whatsoever to the New Deal. Like, you know, when you mentioned 65, I was born in 66. They have no connection to these things, but they have demands. And on some level, it's like, you know, books that you have written provide them the sort of, like, you know, the ability to not have the limited imagination that many of us who grew up in the Reagan era, I think, you know, sort of had on some level. Yeah. And I think that's important.
Yeah.
And that's where I was trying to get you with the green shoots.
The green shoots. Oh, okay. You want me to say something optimistic?
Yes, please.
All right. See you later, Sam.
I feel like that's the way we ended our last interview too.
I don't know. I'll say one thing that's optimistic. So when Bernie Sanders first ran for president, I interviewed him in 2015 or 14. And I thought at the time, you know, I really liked this guy. He basically, he had read my books and basically recited chunks of them back to me. And I was very flattered by that. He didn't say that openly. He's not like, I'm going to quote from your book, but he would say stuff that was clearly very similar to what I was thinking. And I was flattered by that and impressed by that. But I also said at the time, but everybody in DC thinks this guy is a crank. Therefore, he's going to go nowhere. My astonishment and surprise in 2016 at how well he did. And then again in 2020 with everybody mimicking him this time around.
Yep.
That is beyond my wildest dreams of success, what he did. Now I know he's not the nominee, but damn, he came close. He came close. And yeah, the centrists outplayed him again, and succeeded in beating him. But There'll be another Sanders. That's not going to end. And let's hope for better luck next time around. I mean, it's got to happen. It's simply got to happen. Or maybe Joe Biden will. Here's another one. Maybe Joe Biden will turn out to be a great guy.
Come on, man. All right. Well, Thomas Frank.
He actually might. You don't know. I mean, lots of people, like everybody here in DC loves this guy.
I've been saying that there's two types of politicians I like. One's like AOC and Bernie Sanders with their politics. And then Cyphers are my second favorite type of politician. And because there's at least an opportunity. Yeah. And I think Joe Biden is a cipher in many respects. So there is an opportunity, but that is incumbent upon all of us to pick up the mantle. Thomas Frank, the book is The People Know, A Brief History of Populism. We'll put a link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure talking.
Sam, no, pleasure is all mine, believe me.
All right, Thomas. We'll talk to you later.
Bye. See ya.
All right, folks. We went super long. Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. I've been interviewing him for so many years now that it's
casual.
Catch up. It's casual. It was a casual. It was a fun conversation. Fascinating stuff. And I think it's really important for people to read this stuff and, you know, expand your imagination and understanding of where this country has been at different points and where it could go. That's very, very important. Going to take a quick break, go into the fun half of the program. Want to remind you, I'm very excited to introduce you to one of the coolest sponsors that we've had, Hunt a Killer. It's a murder mystery subscription box, and it's one of the most unique games out there. It brings the fun of an escape room to your home. Go to hunttokiller.com/majority. Use the promo code majority at checkout for 20% off your first box. That's hunttokiller.com/majority. Promo code majority. Don't forget, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajoritireport.com. Your membership helps us, you know, strive for upgraded cameras and microphones and whatever it is, and expand. We've got the AM Quickie right now. Going to try and monetize that soon. We've been doing it almost for a year, and the COVID threw us off a little bit, but tons of folks are starting to listen to it now. AMQAMQuickie.com, or you can just find it on any of your podcast subscriptions. It is completely free. You can listen to it, or you can watch it on YouTube at Majority Report Live, youtube.com, Majority Report Live. That's our backup channel, and you can check that out. Reminder, Nomi Key's show happens right after this one at 3 p.m., youtube.com/the Nomi Key Show. God, M-I-K-I. So check that out.
It's not really the pronunciation you have wrong. It's more the rhythm.
It is. I know exactly what it is. It's because I'm from Massachusetts. I put the emphasis on the wrong vowel for just about every word that I speak. And I cannot, and I have some type of like, mental, it's not a mental block about her name in particular. Cause I have this, I still, for the life of me, I can't write a word with I and E. Like I know, I know the I before E, except after C. And even that, I still can't. I always switch the E and the I.
Yeah,
it's very strange. But so that's my mental problem, and I don't think it's going to get corrected, folks. I'm sorry. I mean, that ship has sailed. Check out the Antifada at patreon.com/antifada. Jamie's show, and Matt, what's happening on TMBS?
Yeah, tonight on TMBS, Joshua Kahn, Russell, and Ben Burgess, so some TMBS regulars. We're going to be talking with Ben about his sort of like retrospective on John Ronson's about half decade old book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, and what that sort of, I think it doesn't mention cancel culture in that book, but it's a book sort of about cancel culture. And surprise, it doesn't even mainly come from the left, but we're going to be talking about that tonight.
Right. Also, folks, don't forget shop.majorityreportradio.com. We've got a bunch of swag. We got new stuff coming soon. And I'm working on, we'll talk about this tomorrow, the 10-year anniversary stuff. All right, quick break. I'm going to try and do the phones, but we were having a little bit of phone problem, but I will set up the IM right now. And maybe I won't even do the phones today because we'll try it tomorrow. You can IM the show at majorityapp.com. Pick up the app, and that will be that. See you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands
up.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.